This is a reading from the Lotus Sutra, extracted and adapted for today. After the end of the true Dharma king's reign, extremely arrogant monks and nuns had great power. At that time, a monk appeared who did not devote himself solely to reading and writing holy words. He simply just went out on the town and started bowing to everyone he met, including cows, dogs, and cats. He bowed to everyone he met, whether monk, nun, or layperson, and praised them, saying, "I deeply respect you. I would never dare to disrespect you. Why? Because you are all practicing the Bodhisattva way and surely will become Buddhas." His fellow monks became resentful. Those who saw him bowing to others became angry. Many lay people became enraged and mean-spirited. They reviled and cursed him. Some began to hit him with stones, sticks, or broken sharp tiles, forcing him to run away from them. But still, even at a distance, this monk exclaimed, "I wouldn't dare disrespectful you. You are all Buddhas." The community was livid. They started saying to each other, "This ignorant monk, he takes it on himself to announce that everyone he does, that he doesn't respect us. That the more we hit him, the more he assures us we'll become Buddhas. Who does he think he is? And why does he think we care? We have no use for him. We don't need such empty, false assurances, especially from him." This gentle monk heard these words, but he didn't react. Even as he faced angry crowds throwing dung, he never became angry or enraged, and always responded with the same phrase, "Surely you will all become Buddhas." He was mocked and abused this way for many years. The angry religious community began to call him by a name, "Never Disrespectful." Never Disrespectful believed deeply in his heart that every day he met several Buddhas. He also loved the world and its people. Now growing old and coming to the end of his life's journey, he looked into the beautiful sky and smiled in awe and gratitude. He heard music and saw rainbows. When he next encountered all those who had thrown trash, sticks, and broken tile at him, when he met the monks and nuns of his monastery, those who had shown contempt for him, they did not greet him with harsh words. Instead, they bowed with sudden respect. As he blessed them in his usual way, they heard joyful, eloquent speech and were moved by his great tranquility. He continued to live a long life and was revered among those who once turned him away. The evil age of his appearance turned into a great age of awakening. Never Disrespectful taught many more people about how to be never disrespectful because, he said, we are all Buddhas. Good morning. Let's take a deep breath, and everyone sing with me, Thank you so much for this opportunity to be part of worship today with this wonderful, diverse, and thriving community who actively supports social justice. Our revolutionary and prophetic practices come from our first and seventh principles, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. Did you know that your presence, your voice, indeed your very place here, was predicted in an ancient Buddhist text? The founder of Zen Buddhism, also refers to social justice and yourselves as active Buddhas. Interpreted by author and Zen teacher Taigen Dan Leighton in his book Zen Questions, Zazen Dojin, and the Spirit of Creative Inquiry, the book goes on to describe active Buddhas as those who bring awesome presence with their body. By believing in the well-being of all, and through this identity practice, they create interconnectivity with the world and with space-time. This happens during a time of deep crisis, and because it was predicted in none other than the Sanskrit text called the Dharma Flower Sutra, or as we all know it, the Lotus Sutra, the teachings of the Shakyamuni Buddha. The Lotus Sutra is a recollection of Buddha's teachings on Vulture Peak. Over the years, descriptions, commentary, and multiple translations were added, sometimes revised, organizing it into about 38 chapters. Buddha's visions were the future of humanity, and its religious and human activities remain relatively unchanged to this day. According to the Lotus Sutra, times described as an evil age appear after the Buddha's death. What follows, the text goes on to say, is the degradation of education with spiritual teachings, quote unquote, going into extinction. Buddha himself describes these times as an evil world of five pollutions: the pollution of age, the pollution of life, the pollution of living beings, the pollution of views, and the pollution of life. When the age is in this chaos, the stains run deep, and greedy and jealous living beings acquire unhealthy roots, full of arrogance, not observing their own errors, failing to observe their precepts, and carefully defending their faults, end quote. The sutra also tells us that in these future times of chaos and fear, millennia after Buddha's death, active Buddhas appear, when needed, to present the teachings in creative new ways. They will be seen, felt, and heard with awesome bodily presence. I'm sure it doesn't surprise you that throughout history, many of our ancestors felt like they were living in evil times. And we usually turn to spiritual practice during these periods of difficulty. Did folk turn to the Lotus Sutra for both comfort and guidance? After all, our ancestors believed in the power of prophecy. To encourage interest, the sutra was also fun reading. Who wouldn't be inspired by descriptions of super beings flying through the air, eyes blazing with glowing colored light, or valleys filled with precious gems, and pure lands of unpolluted skies? Tales of kings and dragons who ruled with righteous morality or intellectual prowess. They had great names too, like Universal Sage, or Medicine King, or Majestic Voice. All before Marvel Comics. Despite this great cast, only one of these magical superheroes, one active or working Buddha, was featured in his own chapter. His name was never disrespectful Bodhisattva. Yeah, the guy in the reading. When never disrespectful Bodhisattva appears, it's through his actions that he becomes, to quote the Zen founder Dogen, an awesome presence with his body. Appearing in an evil age of his own time, not only is his journey recorded in verse and text, but it's one of the few chapters in the early Sanskrit translations that did not go through a lot of reorganization, shift, or change. And the active Buddhist story is so simply powerful, it needed no emphasis, no upgrade, no commentary. His story inspired another Buddhist religious sect besides Zen called Nichiren Shoshu that still is active today. So, wow, what on earth did this guy really do? You heard his story in the readings. A guy who treats everyone well, gets pelted with trash, yelled at, humiliated in public, ostracized. What is the lesson here? Foolishness? Martyrdom? Trauma survivability? Perseverance? How does a guy who treats everyone with, "I respect you, I would never disrespect you, you are following your path, you will become a Buddha someday," have so much influence? Let me put it another way. What would you think of some stranger who said to you, "You're great, you're going to change the world," even after you were not at your best? How would you react? And how do you react to strangers or to those who make you uncomfortable when they compliment you? In my culture, I was raised to be nice, to be polite, never disrespectful. Then I married into a family of debaters and social activists. My father-in-law was a political Jew who did not believe in being kind, but as we say today in seminary, he was a call-outer, calling out injustice, white supremacy, and political hypocrisy. He also never stopped letting his opinion be known, even if it was hurtful and wrong. He challenged you to correct him, but you had to convince him why he was wrong. No one could do that, and this inflexibility left him isolated and filled with enmity. He said to me once that I was not welcome in the family because I never had an opinion. I was always too nice, too complacent. In his view, niceness was equated with complacency. And I'm basically a suck-up who never took sides or gave myself to anything. And on top of that, my Asian-centric culture was backward. "When you have the courage to have an opinion," he said unkindly, "we might have something to talk about." Once he went on a tirade about injustice of racism, equal pay, spreading the wealth around were his topics that day, switching suddenly to his intolerance for people who didn't stand up for themselves, who went along, who conformed, and didn't help others in their communities. His withering gaze fell on me. Something in me rose up. Not anger, but fear. Fear that so much needed to be clarified, or the tyranny of his view would be detrimental to my survival. I spoke. My voice trembled, but I simply said, "Isn't intolerance a form of racism? Shouldn't being nice be a way to get together and talk about differences?" "I don't want to talk about this anymore," was his curt response. After that, my father-in-law started to question me about what I was doing with my life. Despite his unhospitable manner, he was insistent that everyone stay for a meal. He loved to cook, and not leave his house without a jar of homemade jam sourced from the wild plum trees surrounding his property. And though I was afraid of him, I learned how to make wild plum jam, how to prepare a house for Seder or Passover, and the importance of daily domestic rituals as a reminder of the preciousness of freedom and acknowledgement of human rights. Every action I take should impact the future, and everything has value. I just have to discover what that is in people, the land, and my community. That was his passion, a hope that the only life worth living was one that contributes to the uplifting of humanity as a whole. He said this from a place of experience. In the 1950s, he was blacklisted as a communist after he sheltered a homeless student who had pamphlets on Marxism. He lost his job as a chemist and sought out jobs as a plumber, a skill he neither had nor did well with, enduring poverty, isolation, and humiliation. This is what colonization looks like. Learning this about my father-in-law taught me to appreciate what happens when hope is systemically removed by this type of action. Removal of opportunity, of the freedom to act, is one of the pillars of colonization. Pair it with the elimination of hope, replace it with fear, and the colonizers win. My father-in-law believed utterly in freedom. He was, after all, a Jew who practiced the ritual of Seder and used it as a time to remind us that to continue to fight for freedom because it can be taken away. He taught me in his rough Hebraic debate style the importance of thinking for myself and to be sensitive to when the world was trying to make you conform. I remember keeping him up to date about my efforts to organize my isolated neighborhood after the Loma Prieta quake, and how we strangers gathered together and worked together to get our power back on and to share our meager food supplies with each other, and in the end created a political entity to maintain our roads. I watched his face and thought, no, I hoped. I was finally welcome. When asked this, he answered, I never gave up hope. One of the deepest teachings in Buddhist theology is one of hope. The power of hope and love combined cannot be stopped. Never disrespectful Bodhisattva's story deftly presents this concept. He is simply and wholeheartedly devoted to the concept of love and trust in fellow human beings. He never doubted his belief that all beings are Buddhas. And though we are taught that doubt is a good thing, we need to remember that when it comes to truly helping, truly being activist and social justice banner carriers, we cannot have doubts about what we believe or do. We must hope. Recently, this power of hope was shown to a group of us who attended here an Alliance for All group lecture featuring our very own immigrant justice member, Joan Lactis. You should all attend these talks, by the way. Joan shared a PowerPoint about the work of a group called Faithful Friends, a cadre of concerned citizens who visits the Yuba City Detention Center for deportees. She described an environment that actively uses the elimination of hope, dignity, and human connection to control and discourage those seeking asylum here in this country. Joan shared a story about one internee who said he prayed for a sign of hope to keep fighting to stay in the country. And one of us came to him, one of us who believed utterly in the first and through seven, maybe all, principles. And after his long wait and continued fight with us, standing with him in court, he was freed. Hope can win. Connection, rather than conflict, can generate and change our environment. Never disrespectful Bodhisattva's message emerges as an important role to hold strong in hope and pure belief that all will be well, that we are all in transformation through our actions, both of body and mind, striving to create a better world by embracing and trusting in the goodness of those with whom we cohabitate and collaborate. Never disrespectful Bodhisattva's practice in these times is a radical act. Divisiveness among communities is at its highest level of tension yet. We must learn to listen, to have hope, and believe in the people and the world despite levels of encouraged violence. Over the years, my father-in-law simply got angrier and more reclusive. To his family, he was simply ill. To me, the illness came from a terrible loss of hope for the world, for himself, and for his family, who rejected his beliefs with a sounding majority. Many became evangelical, throwing away their Jewish cultural identity for one of what he believed was utterly tyrannical and conforming. As my father-in-law lay in a coma in his hospital bed, I managed to spend a few hours alone with him at the surprise insistence of my mother-in-law, since the entire family questioned my purpose there. My relationship with him was outside the ordinary, born out of my nonconformist act to insert myself into a situation outside my comfort zone. I could have tried not to connect at all, but I braved the pelting of insults from his family and from him and hoped. As I held my Buddhist prayer beads and did mantra, the terror of our relationship and the inspiration of his determination to face in the face of debilitating strokes and an emotionally distant family still left me with a sense of hope. I felt we had finally connected. When he died a few days later, I mourned him, but also celebrated his life by taking action in the world and making wild plum jam. Author and Zen teacher Tygen Dan Leighton says, everything is being transformed, digested, and spit out in each moment. This transformative function happens because of your dignified presence with all beings together right now, today. Tygen's words, interpreted from the Lotus Sutra, describes this congregation. You are awesome in your presence. You welcome everyone. Like never disrespectful Bodhisattva, you are making a difference. From the simple act of sitting here listening to this junior minister to filling this place every Sunday for worship, you do this out of hope. Hope for the work of Unitarian Universalism and hope in the midst of chaos and fear. This is a radical act. You are working active Buddhas. Walk in this beauty. Show up where and when it is least expected. This struggle has greeted humanity before. It can be changed. Hope. Love. Trust with and in every being, not one left behind. Let us never be disrespectful. We are all Buddhas.